Bloomington looks to create tax incentives to help fund its downtown streetscape. School districts aren't often fond, though, of TIF districts.
We want to be able to make sure that we're really good partners and everybody is on board with that.
That's coming up on WGLT's news magazine, Sound Ideas. Good evening, I'm John Norton. Also on today's show, a Bloomington teen gets in on the 21st century version of the space race, researching AI at a Chinese university.
Regardless of where you're from or what your background is, I think everyone's interested in the possibilities that advancements in AI can have.
And meet a suspense thriller author from Normal in the latest episode of Inside Art. Stories after a Bloomington Normal News update. This is Sound Ideas on 89.1 WGLT and WGLT.org, part of the NPR network.
Support for WGLT comes from Bloomington Normal Audiology. Here my story continues with local patients Ralph and Carol Weisite.
I really don't think there was an adjustment period. This ability to hear things in stereo was huge. I love the fact that when my phone rings, it rings through my hearing aids.
Ralph and Carol's full story can be found at bnaudiology.com.
On the campus of Illinois State University in Normal, this is WGLT's news magazine, Sound Ideas. I'm John Norton. Yesterday on the show, Bloomington Mayor Mboka Malambwe discussed his plans to run for a second term. Today, we turn to city business. The Bloomington City Council recently approved the first funding to design the first phase of its downtown streetscape plan. Malambwe tells WGLT's Charlie Schlenker he believes the nearly $60 million plan will be transformational, even if much of the work is centered on infrastructure that may not be visible to the casual eye.
I think it is because some of the infrastructure projects that we're going to see are going to have a major impact, I think, folks not only in the area but also on the west side. When you're talking about the addition of underground detention facilities, separation of combined sewers.
Isn't that what people should already expect, though? How is that going to boost development when you're giving them what they should already have?
Well, I think it's going to boost development because right now it's not there. So I think, certainly when people can see that, there are potential issues, so they're not inclined to invest in that area. But what you're going to see, in my opinion, is that you're going to see a lot more investment. Then there is other things like that we're going to add, fiber optic, but also things like for Wi-Fi, EV chargers, and other things like that that will not only help to more investment, increase traffic, and that kind of thing. So foot traffic is very important.
There is less than unanimous support for some of the later phases, the non-infrastructure phases. Mm-hmm. Since there are some cold feet on the council, even at this early stage, does that bode not well for the council being willing to see this through?
I don't think so, because for one, so all the the phases are pretty flexible, right? So we'll it will depend, although they're numbered 1 through 10, but we can always choose to do one or the other at any given time.
Is flexibility really a virtue, though, because you can choose to do none?
Very true, very true. But I do think, with the flexibility that we have, is that you can put some projects in front of others because, one, you're able to maybe get some grant funding. That is one area that we are very committed to, and we are going to be very, very aggressive. And I think once you have that momentum and people see things happening, I think they might be a little bit more open to it. And I have to remind you, when we had the plan initially, the funding for the plan, $750,000, it was a 5-4 vote. So people weren't, you know, all that enthused about it initially. You know, certainly that we had a couple of different council members, but now we have a plan that, you know, is was unanimous in its approval. So, you know, things can change over time as people get more educated about it.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with Mayor Mboka Mulambwe of the City of Bloomington. The city is considering adoption of a tax increment financing district for the downtown area. There will be a public meeting on that on April 29th. Tax increment financing uses the increase in real estate taxes coming from the increase in the value of properties that are improved to pay for certain redevelopment project costs. So how large is the proposed TIF in area?
Well, it hasn't been determined yet. You know, and that's going to be part of the process, you know, that will start on April 29th. So certainly, you know, you can say for sure it's going to include the Buckle in downtown, but it could also be expanded a little bit further. So I think that's going to be part of the discussions.
How far is District 87 willing to have that district spread?
Well, I think that is also part of the conversation that will take place, because you know there is a joint review board that gets together and has conversations about that. But one thing that we always make sure we know, that is a it's always a concern, you know, for school districts, and that's something that we'll have discussions with them. We want to be able to make sure that we're really good partners and everybody is on board with that.
In at least one prior TIF redevelopment project, District 87 was specifically included in the revenue sharing from any revenue from the TIF. Is that necessary to do again?
Well, I don't want to, you know, to speak ahead of others. I know there's a process for that, but I'm pretty sure that will be, could be part of the conversation.
The council has approved a $331 million budget for the new fiscal year, a 14% increase over the previous year, $88-89 million planned for capital projects. Ward 3 council member Sheila Montney voted against the budget, saying that the road repair amount is the same as the previous year, so that's actually a decline after inflation. Is the city effectively losing ground?
I don't believe so, because I think you have to look at one, what we do in terms of street repair is also conditioned by, you know, by what we have available in terms of workforce with the the various companies. If you remember several years back, I think we were in the $7 to $8 million. Now we're at about $10 million in street repair that we do out of our locomotive fuel tax, but also adding some money from the general fund. And that is because the staff has worked with the local contractors to offer maybe a smaller the type of projects that they can bid on.
That was Bloomington Mayor Mboka Mulambwe speaking with WGLT's Charlie Schlenker. Tomorrow on Sound Ideas, you'll hear about a new book commissioned by the Dirksen Congressional Center in Pekin. It takes a closer look at President Donald Trump's impact on the Senate.
For restaurant chains looking to grow and reach new customers, it is all about, say it with me now, location, location, location. Scouting for new stores, next time on Marketplace.
Listen to Marketplace beginning at 5:30 this afternoon on WGLT, sponsored by CEFQ.
It's something that no other affluent nation is facing. In the U.S., gun violence is the number one cause of death for children and adolescents. In part three of our series on guns in America, we hear from young people about their experiences with gun violence.
I got into a little fight, and that's when I put out my gun. I ain't want to shoot nobody.
Tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News. Listen between 4 and 9 a.m. on 89.1 WGLT.
Sound Ideas is WGLT's news magazine. I'm John Norton. While most kids his age were at the pool or playing video games last summer, one Bloomington teen spent his vacation at a Chinese university. He was researching AI technology on deep-sea submersibles and drone swarms. Shashi Salavat is a junior at the Illinois Math and Science Academy in Aurora, IMSHA for short. Salavat applied for the rigorous boarding school as a freshman at Normal Community High School and got in. He tells WGLT's Lauren Warnicke he's always gravitated toward math and computer science, and so far, he's had no regrets going to IMSA. Well, maybe just one.
I did miss like some of my mom's cooking sometimes. That took a little bit of adjusting too, but as I got used to it, like I'm a junior now, it's been so much easier since then. But, you know, looking back, I haven't looked back ever since.
Because you're in a residential high school, this was missing out on additional time that you could have been at home over the summer, right? So how long were you there? And any regrets?
I was there for a little under a month.
Okay.
And I have no regrets. Like, it was an awesome experience, top to bottom. From the very moment we got on the airline, it was just we were introduced to a new culture. Some of their undergrad students were kind of assigned to be our lab PIs and our investigators. So they were with us, they'd eat with us. We'd play like soccer afterwards when we had time. So I remember the first time they taught us like how to use chopsticks. And I got really fluent at using chopsticks. So it was a cultural experience. But on top of that, they had really great cutting edge facilities. They had amazing 3D printers. We had a lot of presentations from people in the top of their fields. One of the things I worked on was looking at remote operated vehicles and how we could use them underwater, as well as drone swarms, which was another very interesting kind of work we looked at. It was research like this that was also really cool. So just the experience overall was it was pretty amazing, and I would say it was a summer like pretty well spent.
It makes a whole lot of sense to me that we would need submersible vehicles that could be like remote operated to understand like deep water ecosystems that people and even people in submarines can't access. How does what you specifically did interact with that work?
The role of AI in these systems is, okay, like if we are looking at how we could use maybe computer vision, for example, which is like a sub branch of AI to recognize new species or look at new coral or like things like that in the deep sea. That could also, pave the way for other autonomous tasks that could happen. We also looked at the OceanGate submarine disaster, which I'm sure you've heard of last year. So things like that, where if certain things fail also on a hardware level, we could have AI that can, like onboard AI that can intelligently kind of adapt to changing conditions. AI implementation is great for new insights and learning new things about species, ecosystems, etc. But also on a hardware level, If things were to go wrong, or if there's a sudden need for navigation, AI could automatically kind of take over.
Yeah, I'm thinking about like Houston, we have a problem. All of a sudden becomes like a joint effort of humans and technology to solve a problem and potentially make that type of scientific exploration more safe. And as you mentioned, like possibly explore new things that are not currently accessible or identifiable by humans, right? But I think one of the rubs with AI is feeling like AI first has to learn from us, from the information that we give to it. At this nascent stage of it, there's a lot of opportunity for AI to get it wrong.
We actually had a tub that we were like testing on, and it was a very small like four propeller like remote operated like vehicle. We had a small controller, and it was just like a tub. So sometimes we'd put objects in the way. The algorithm's task was to avoid this object, like learn how to avoid this object. A part of that could be if it took the wrong path, we'd tell it in the UI, we'd be like, no, this is the wrong path. And then it would know that, be like, okay, like this is the wrong path. This is the wrong approach I took. Let me try something else. So in that way, and these take a very long time to train, like maybe after 100 tries, we could finally get it to avoid the obstacles. So these things take time to train as well, which is kind of another bottleneck we see in training these AIs. But obviously, making sure they're safe and accurate is kind of at the forefront of what we're trying to do here.
I wonder at which point the robot becomes smarter than the human and that it has to teach us rather than the other way around. You know what I mean?
The rate of progression with this whole AI boom is really astonishing, the progression we've made. If you've looked at the new, the Sora models from OpenAI, where you can put in like a text prompt and it will generate you like a full, like high resolution video.
Yeah.
The advances that are being made is absolutely insane. And the path forward is looking at examining the limitations of AI and also making sure that they're used in a safe way. Even now we've seen kind of some misuse of AI, whether that be deepfake technology or some sort of image generation that could be fake. And that also raises the question of data ownership, because for AI we need to use a lot of data. Like, there's no question about that. Just the more data you have, the more I guess the better your AI model will be. So these questions are something that a lot of different, probably a lot of other researchers and a lot of other groups are looking at and asking questions about. So these concerns need to be looked at before. I think at least that they're very important to be looked at before we look at any like wide scale implementation.
Yeah, I don't know that this is a question for a high schooler, but I'm going to try it anyway. And I think it relates to the idea that this really was also a cultural exchange and maybe in some ways international diplomacy between the U.S. and China. And I guess I'm thinking back to the space race, right? Like that there were efforts from various countries to like achieve something first and then leverage that technology. So it seems interesting to me that China would be, a university in China would be working on this very nascent, like potentially world-changing technology and would invite Americans into that process.
Regardless of where you're from or what your background is, I think everyone, whether that be, researchers or people who are actively working in the field to, the average, worker, I think everyone's interested in the possibilities that advancements in AI can have. So it was more a diversity of the flow of ideas. We have so many different fields that this is like immediately applicable to. And that's what makes it, such an interesting time to be in and to work in.
In addition to his work on remote-operated vehicles, Salavat participated on a Chinese research team investigating how drone swarms and 3D printers might be used to construct major infrastructure. He says we're still a long way away from robots building bridges and skyscrapers, though. Shashi Salavat spoke with WGLT's Lauren Warnicki. This is Sound Ideas on 89.1 WGLT. I'm John Norton. WGLT's video series, Inside Art, highlights the behind-the-scenes process artists in Central Illinois go through to produce their art. The latest episode features independent suspense and thriller author Sue Rovins of Normal. Rovins is retired, but she worked at ISU's Milner Library for over 30 years.
I'm what you would call a pantster. You fly by the seat of your pants. I sit down here and I go, okay, story one. and then it comes out like that. I worked at Milner Library for just over 30 years. I ended up as the Stacks maintenance manager. And I did that for probably the majority of my time there. At that time, there were 1.6 million books in Milner. And I was in charge of getting at least most of those back to where they belong. It's a great coincidence that working at Milner and me being an author kind of gelled. It didn't necessarily, one didn't necessarily affect the other. It just kind of happened that way. I always wanted to be a writer, but my mom passed away in 2009, and that really set me thinking of, if you want to do something, to do it. So I started, and the very first book I wrote was a book of short stories, because my mom and I, we enjoyed watching One Step Beyond and Twilight Zone and all those type of things. And I dedicated that first book to her. Paperback, rise up, rise up. I do NaNoWriMo every 2 years. That's National Novel Writing Month. That takes place in November. It's free. Anybody can do it. You take 30 days to write 50,000 words. So I was able to get 50,000 words in the month November. That gives me a first draft of everything. And I wrote literally just like little snippets of paper. You know, I usually have these all over the place. And then I sit down, no music, no talking to other people, no texting or phones, just quiet. I'm usually looking out this window or at a cat. And I'm just thinking, where do I go from here? I would say my books really fall under the umbrella of suspense and thriller, kind of horror adjacent. I like following characters in weird, surreal situations. Years ago, I was fortunate enough to go to Germany for an 8-day vacation, and I've never seen a train station so big. It was overwhelming to me. It was just, oh my gosh. So I wanted that to be part of a story. Track 9, my second book, it's about a haunted train station in Germany, and there's people from Bloomington trapped in the station. After the first draft is done, the end of November, I set it aside for a few months. I do up to 9 drafts. Usually around draft 6 or 7, I'll send it to my beta readers. They'll give me ideas like, this made no sense, or I didn't follow this. These are pages of mistakes and issues. When you think it's totally finished, there's over 120 things that I catch even after 9 drafts. Things that are like, oh, I used too many ellipses, or there's not a quotation, or anything like that. I try to make the best product I can. And it takes 2 years to do that for me. Even though I'm retired now, I can't sit here for 8 hours a day and do it. 2 hours is my limit. If it's too much like work, I'm not going to do it. It's not something that you do to get rich. It really isn't. I'm sure I'm not making money. I don't think I'm even breaking even. According to my last few years of taxes, they're like, no, no. But to get the books out there, you know, that's the big thing. I want to entertain people. You know, I don't want any one particular hobby or interest to just be so consuming. You know, it's just a part. It's a part of who I am.
Sue Robin's books can be found in many places, including Milner Library, Bob's Bay Books, and on her website. WGLT's Emily Bollinger produces the Inside Art video series, and you can see all of them right now at WGLT.org. And that's Sound Ideas today. WGLT's news magazine is made possible in part by Bloomington Normal Audiology. I'm John Norton with story help today from WGLT's Charlie Schlenker and Lauren Warnicki, and from student reporter Emily Bollinger. Ryan Tuohy edits Sound Ideas. This is 89.1 WGLT and WGLT.org, part of the NPR network.